Thank you, Ms. Toomey.
Good afternoon.
And who is going to be arguing for the Arlington County Department of Social Services?
Your Honor, my name is Jason McCallis. I'm Assistant County Attorney.
Okay, thank you so very much. Ms. Wolf?
Your Honor, Janelle Wolf, I'm the guardian ad litem in this case.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Toomey, would you like to have any time in rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes, please, for rebuttal.
5 minutes?
Okay, and may it please the court. Your Honor, this case primarily is about the authority of the court to modify an order once that order has become final. The law is very clear that a final order cannot be modified more than 21 days have passed from the date of entry unless the subject matter involves exceptions that we've discussed, custody, support, or visitation, and that those modifications serve to effectuate and enforce the prior order. So we've got basically a sort of a two-pronged standard here. This particular no-contact order, it's our position, and we submit that it does not involve custody, support, or visitation, and nor does it effectuate or enforce the prior order. The other portions of this appeal are that if the court decides that the trial court did have the authority to make the modifications, that those modifications were primarily unduly restrictive and vague, interfered with the appellant's ability to litigate claims and to consult with attorneys, essentially violating her attorney-client privilege, and also violated the appellant's right to free speech.
Well, doesn't the court have the authority to enforce its own orders?
Yes, of course. An enforcement action would be how this case originated, by a contempt proceeding.
Is that the only way?
Well, I think that an enforcement action could potentially come by way of maybe an order that explains or clarifies certain terms. But this order basically blew that out of the water. It created a whole new course of conduct that was being prohibited, even conduct that didn't even include not having contact with the child.
But this amendment it was an amendment to an order that was issued from a custody proceeding, wasn't it?
It was an order that was issued. It was a termination proceeding, and yes, that
yet,
is a custody.
Yet your claim is that this is not governed by 20-124.2.
It's our position that the no contact order doesn't speak to those subject matters, that it's a separate order. Even though it arose out of a custody proceeding, it's a separate order because contact is much broader than, of course, custody and even visitation.
Ms. Toomey, let me, and I don't mean to be rude in this word, but we consider the law is not an ass. And
I'm sorry,
say
the
law is not an ass. And the idea behind that is that a no contact order and an incidental or unintended contact is not one that's prohibited. It would not be encompassed in an order. It's the intentional violation of coming into contact normally with an individual. And what I'm hearing here is there are lots of ways that she could unintentionally violate this order and be punished, and therefore the order should be not good. Is that right?
Well, obviously intention is a subject of fact that would have to be determined by the court, mm-hmm. but we do believe that there are certain ways that she could, say, determine where the child would be that might be an intentional act, but if, for example, if she searched the child's name on the internet and found something that says where the child is, well, she intentionally searched the child's name on the internet, but so that's an intentional act. But it certainly has nothing to do with contact, the original purpose of the order.
Let's go back to Judge Felton's question. There was a no contact order entered July 27, 2012.
That was the original no contact.
Right.
Yes.
And then the evidence is that on numerous occasions she violated that order. Right?
Well, the judge did, of course, dismiss the contempt action.
That wasn't my question. My question is, wasn't there evidence that she violated the order? That she drove by the place where the child was attending a barbecue, shouted the child's nickname, drove by the same location, and so forth?
That was the evidence, yes.
All right, so based on that, and the trial court perhaps thought maybe that wasn't intentional, although she wore a wig and so forth, but the trial court deemed perhaps that didn't show an intent. So then to better enforce that order, he then amended it and made it tighter. Now, why doesn't the court have jurisdiction to enforce its own order and protect the interests of the child, which it did or attempted to do by virtue of the July 27th no contact order?
Well, we believe that the order just went too far and went beyond enforcement and effectuation of the order. For example, by ordering that Ms. Heffernan could not do certain things, such as discuss the case with anyone other than a licensed attorney, that certainly has nothing to do with defining contact. That has nothing to do with contact, or even attempted contact, or even incidental contact, or anything really at all related to contact.
But by the time that amended order was entered, hadn't the termination proceeding been concluded?
Yes.
So she legally was a stranger to this child?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
With respect to some of the other points, I'd like to, I guess, more focus on the free speech element. And free speech has never been required to be only with respect to something that you have a legitimate interest in. I mean, so the child still remains biologically her grandchild, although she did raise her, so Ms. Heffernan refers to her as my child. But under this modified order, there can be no discussions about anything with respect to the child with even her own family or friends, so she would not be allowed to even have a private conversation in her own home.
Help me why she could not be able to do that within the parameters of general First Amendment and free speech.
Well, Your Honor, we submit that that there would be nothing that would restrict her other than this order from simply discussing her own child with a family or friend, but this order does that. So it's limiting her speech, even though in this particular case it may be private speech. The more public speech would be the provision about posting things on the internet.
Well, factually, didn't she make some fairly bad comments on the internet about this child?
There was, the trial judge considered that she had posted this motion in limine, which included a psychological evaluation of the child. And we do not dispute that the particular provision of the order ordering her to take that down or not doing that is fine. We would not argue with the fact that the judge could say, you cannot post legal pleadings in a private juvenile case on the internet, or you cannot post protected health or psychiatric information on the internet. We wouldn't have any problem with that. It's just this blanket prohibition that we have a problem with.
But even prior restraint is permitted if there's a compelling state interest, and in this case it was the compelling state interest of protecting the best interest of the child.
Correct.
And the court, in exasperation because of the repeated violations of the order, was trying to make it perfectly clear that your client needed to stop that.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I think what our position is just that these restrictions could have been more narrowly tailored to accomplish that interest, such as limiting exactly.
Well, don't we do First Amendment as applied test, that is, whether or not there's a violation of a court order would be seen in the manner in which the order attempts to restrict speech, and it's as an applied standard. If she is in a room with the other family members talking about this child or anything about that child, there's nothing in the court order that could be conceived to apply to that situation. But yet, if she's sitting in the back of an elementary school room talking about, that's my child and you're doing my child wrong, or they're all messing with her, would that not be a sanctionable violation of her speech because of her prior activity? Under the First Amendment law.
I mean, I have to be honest, I'm not that familiar with First Amendment law. I only did as much research as I really...
No, we understand. And the purpose of our dialogue here is to help us all understand what really the trial court may have erred and what the trial court did. And the dialogue is to try to help us all understand that.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I would submit that if she was in the elementary school classroom, I wouldn't see... there would be no reason that she couldn't make those statements that you had said. Similarly, just in conversations with private people.
What was the genesis of this order that you're claiming to be violating her First Amendment rights? How did that order come to be?
The contempt proceeding that was brought and that was then dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what brought this about. And I'm into my yellow, so I
would like to... Let me quickly ask you this. The First Amendment jurisprudence talks about restricting speech as opposed to conduct.
Yes.
Now, aren't these the amended order prohibiting various conduct?
I don't believe so. I believe that... Well, I think that posting things on the internet could potentially be conduct, such as if you take a particular document, like a motion in limine, and post it on the internet. I would say that is more conduct. But if, for example, speech would be, is if she wanted to, you know, post her status on Facebook and say something like, you know, today is my child's birthday, I love her, I miss her, that would be pure speech and certainly involve no conduct, but that would violate the court's order.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
We saved your time. Mr. McClandis?
Your Honors, may it please the court. With respect to the jurisdictional issue, I would
let me ask a question. Are you going to split any time with regarding?
Ms. Wolf advised that she did not wish to,
okay,
to take any time, so I'll be using the full amount if I may. If I could speak to the jurisdictional issue first, I know that in the brief, counsel for the appellant really kind of glosses over the issue of whether the court initially had jurisdiction. And it's the department's position that there clearly was jurisdiction to go under that statute to enter that no contact order. Your Honors actually ruled in a pretty lengthy published opinion last year in Tackett v. County of Arlington. One of the issues among many was the validity of the no contact order that was originally at issue in July of 2012. And the court found that the circuit court did have authority to enter that order. Now, this custody statute was not mentioned in that argument, I don't believe. But the issue that's raised by counsel is whether or not Judge Fiore had the authority to modify that order from July of 2012 when at the conclusion of this contempt proceeding. And our position is that he did, because any way you look at that statute, the termination proceeding, Ms. O'Brien's custody proceeding, which was held at the same time as the termination proceeding, and the permanency planning proceeding, all of those things were done at the same time. And at the conclusion of those proceedings, the circuit court judge in July of 2012 entered that no contact order. And that order not only denied custody to Ms. O'Brien, but it granted a final custody to the department in conclusion of the TPR proceeding. So I don't think there's any way that you can interpret that statute not to be considered, that type of a proceeding be considered a custody or visitation proceeding.
Now, if the child is 18 years of age, the child is free to contact the appellant here, or the appellant is free to contact the child here?
I believe so, Your Honor, because the statute says that it gives the court authority to continue to exercise jurisdiction until the child turns 18. And so if the child, AO, in this case, were to decide when she turns 18 that she wants to have contact with her grandmother, and if the grandmother still seeks to have contact with her, I don't believe that the court would continue to have authority to prohibit that.
Counsel, even do we need to get to whether this is visitation or custody? Court always has the authority to modify and to enforce its order. Why isn't that the bottom line in this case?
Well, I think the court's point is well taken, I would submit to the court that if the court had added just to the termination order a provision saying, and as part of this termination order, I also order the grandmother not to have any contact, or if it was an order in any other type of proceeding, the court does have the power to enforce through its contempt powers the provisions of that order. To the particular point that's raised by counsel, though, it's the department's contention that this court, the circuit court clearly had jurisdiction to continue to modify the order from July 2012 up until the child turns 18. And the ultimate sort of guiding principle here is the best interest of the child. That always has to take precedence for every case. When you're dealing with a minor, it's often repeated throughout the statutory scheme. And in this case, the court found, and we would submit, it was clearly in the best interest of the child for the order to be modified such as it was. I would also point out that when you're talking about things being narrowly tailored, counsel says a number of times in her brief and before this court today that it was too broad. But unfortunately, Ms. O'Brien has created the circumstances that required the court to cast sort of a broader net with its court order. The court has been very concerned about making sure that the child's privacy is protected, that the child is not going to be inappropriately contacted by Ms. O'Brien or any of her surrogates. Your Honor's written opinion from 2013, the Tackett case, it actually recounted a lot of the facts. It was a pretty long opinion. It recounted a lot of the facts, which included, the grandmother withholding the child. The child went into foster care, and the child disappeared and turned up with the grandmother in Maryland. Law enforcement had to go and get the child from her. So, the danger inherent in the grandmother's contact with the child is very real. It continues to be very real, just as real as it was back in 2012 and 2013 when the TPR and the appeal to the Court of Appeals was pending. Unfortunately, with this violation that was adjudicated and, as counsel pointed out, was dismissed, we still see the same pattern of activity from this grandmother. And so the court's challenge has been to try to figure out a way to curtail her activities so that this child is appropriately protected.
Does the looking at the modified order focusing on the provision paragraph number 3 that Ms. O'Brien was shall not discuss any information whatsoever regarding AO absent good cause shown in further order of the court, does that language, absent good cause shown, provide, does that assist us or affect in any way the First Amendment prior restraint analysis?
Well, Judge, the department's position is that the type of speech that is being curtailed it doesn't rise to the level of First Amendment protected speech. That's number one. But I think what Your Honor is asking is whether, even if it is, does that good cause sort of give a further justification to the court to curtail that speech, even if it is speech that's covered by the First Amendment? And I think that it is, because ultimately, if there's going to be a violation of this, it's going to be brought through a show cause. It'll be pursued as a criminal contempt, potentially. And the court is going to have to find that there was a mens rea there in order for it to find them guilty of a violation of this, a criminal violation of this order. And so I think the good cause, it does give Ms. O'Brien an avenue to argue that her behavior was justified, her use of Ashley in a conversation was justified.
Well, isn't this an invitation by the court for Ms. O'Brien to come back and say, look, I just want to have a discussion with someone, who, you know, a name, about the fact that it's my child's birthday is coming up. I just want to have that conversation. Is this an invitation for her to come to the court and get that permission in advance?
I think the history of this case and the record from the prior case will show that Ms. O'Brien has continually tried to exploit what she perceives to be loopholes in these orders. She's been very savvy and resourceful in that regard. And so my answer is yes. I think that it gives her an opening, but there's lots of provisions here that I would imagine she would perceive to give her an opening so that she could try to contact the child or
some of the wording here is very broad, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to does the fact that Ms. O'Brien has brought this upon herself have any bearing in our First Amendment analysis?
In the First Amendment analysis?
Yes, sir.
Well, I would say with the First Amendment analysis, you know, if the court is determining, you know, just for the sake of argument, that this speech is covered by the First Amendment,
right,
then the question becomes, you know, whether or not it's content neutral, et cetera. And then, even if it's not content neutral, or is the interest of the government in curtailing this speech such that you know, it rises to the level where the court should do it?
This is not content neutral. You agree with that?
Well, it's not. I mean, if by content neutral you mean just saying anything at all about a particular person, if that's not content neutral, then yes, I would agree with that. But also, I would point out that I think it was mentioned earlier, if speech is simply conduct, it just happens to be the utterance of words, then that doesn't trigger a First Amendment analysis because it's not covered by the First Amendment. But just for the sake of argument, counsel in her pleading stipulates that there's a compelling interest to protect the well-being of the child here. And so to the extent that the court has in the past tried different measures to control the activities of Ms. O'Brien, it continues to I've already used this term before, but sort of broaden the net so that it can control her behavior. I think it does factor in the First Amendment analysis that way because it shows that the court is using the most narrowly tailored tools it has at its disposal to address the best interest and the compelling state interest that is the best interest of this child. And so to that extent, I would say it does factor into the analysis somewhat.
In that the court had tried a narrower approach before, that didn't work, and so something broader was going to be required in order to effectuate the purpose of protecting a child's interest.
Right. I think that narrowly tailored is a term that requires the court to analyze the facts in the history to determine whether it's sufficiently narrowly tailored to address the circumstances at hand. And in this case, the department's position is that Judge Fiore tried very hard to do that. He heard quite a bit of testimony about these activities that Ms. O'Brien had conducted. You know, she moved, you know, a couple of blocks away from where the child was staying for no other apparent reason other than to try to maintain contact.
Well, there's no question that Ms. O'Brien, Heffernan, whatever her name is, devoutly cares for this child. I mean, that is without question. And that the termination of her daughter's parental rights and the guardian ad litemship that she had when she brought the child home from the hospital and Thackett delivered the child, all are very much a part of what's driving her. And in doing so, she's probably not the usual person out there. I have no doubt that she's driven by a sincere devotion and love to this child, never have. But what is also at play here is, to what extent is her conduct becoming such that it's interfering with the normalcy of the child's life and the state's attempt to protect that interest. I keep thinking about this First Amendment and fire in the crowded theater. You know, there are limitations to free speech that are properly protected, and the question, of course, here is this one of them?
Well, and Judge Fiore was being mindful of the facts from the previous case, where the child's name and information, photograph, was being plastered all over the internet, on blogs, on Facebook, by either Ms. O'Brien or one of her surrogates. You know, I already mentioned the episode of her being effectively taken from the agency for a period of weeks before law enforcement recovered her from Maryland. She then spent time in a residential treatment facility, you know, to deal with some of the results of that. And subsequent to that, you know, there were episodes where the grandmother secreted cell phones, admittedly secreted cell phones, to the child during a period where she wasn't supposed to be having contact with the child. I mean, there's just a long history of attempts by the grandmother to circumvent court orders and to have contact with the child. Now, during the initial foster care case that resulted in the termination in July 2012, the child actually got on the stand and testified that she wanted to go home, that she you know, didn't want rights to be terminated. But when she testified during the proceeding that's in this record, you see a completely different child, a child who actually wants her grandmother to stay away. And so it is having an impact on this child when her grandmother shows up and is yelling across the yard nickname.
Sure.
And I think that goes to the compelling interest that this court has to protect the child's best interest, and I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McClanis. Mr. Toomey, you have a few minutes left to help us out here.
Thank you, Your Honors. Well, I guess if there aren't any other additional questions, we didn't really talk too much about the ability to consult with an attorney, and I think, and Judge Huff, you had mentioned, you know, does this good cause shown and further the court invite her to file a motion. I know that when in the trial court, the trial judge and I were going back and forth about her ability to consult with a D.C. attorney and file these certain other claims.
But that's not attorney-client privilege.
Well,
did you raise that below?
I don't believe that I ever said the words attorney-client privilege, but I said litigate claims and consult with her D.C. attorney.
But so that's a substantially different. Attorney-client privilege is whether or not the communication between the attorney and the client can be told to others.
Well, I would submit, and I cited in my reply brief, there was a legal ethics opinion that says that even when somebody consults with an attorney, that is also protected by the attorney-client privilege. And in this case, were she to be required to file a motion, of course, any motion would have to be delivered to opposing counsel. And she would then have to disclose in her motion, I want to consult with XYZ attorney. So we believe that even though the trial court gave her that option to file such a motion, that would still violate the attorney client.
Was there something in the factual background that caused the court to add that provision?
There had been some mention of, I believe, a claim filed in DC. I believe it was with the D.C., I guess it originally started in, I'm not familiar with that D.C. courts, but I guess it originally started in the trial courts of D.C. and then it was appealed up to the Court of Appeals in D.C. And in the termination case, there was also comparable Maryland litigation going on as well.
Okay, so there's parallel litigation in the past that has gone on in other jurisdictions pertaining to the child that this
Correct.
Virginia court
Yes.
is dealing with.
Correct.
Thank you.
And so that's why we had obviously been, we were very concerned that that would be limiting her ability to consult with that attorney. And for example, if she, and I believe we had cited this, wanted to make a complaint with the federal United States Department of Health and Human Services or Medicaid fraud or those types of things, that she would be limited in doing so under this order. If there are no other questions, I would submit all my briefs.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Toomey.